Come on then. I'll tell you when. Okay? Okay, awesome. Hold on to that. All right. So this is the second and last talk in the book of Habakkuk or Habakkuk. I tend to say Habakkuk, just rolls off the tongue. More fun. And I just sort of think maybe the double K thing says Habakkuk. Anyway, so just a quick recap. The story, the book is in the time just before the Babylonian Empire comes and destroys Jerusalem. The last remnant of Israel that exists on earth as a nation, which is the tribes of Benjamin and Judah, they're the last ones clinging on. The 10 tribes up in Samaria, they're long gone, about a century ago. And this last remnant's hanging on, and Habakkuk has this complaint to God, saying, God, why haven't you sorted out Israel? He's looked at the kings and the leadership, he's looked at the way the people live, and he's criticizing God for not sorting them out. And God responds to his complaint, and he makes Habakkuk's situation worse. Habakkuk thought he had a complaint, first of all, when he said, God, why don't you sort out Israel? And he has an even worse one when God says, I am sorting out. I am sending the godless and violent Babylonians to deal with Israel. I am sending the Babylonians. Which causes Habakkuk's second complaint, which goes along the lines of, how dare you? How can you? You are the pure and holy God. How can you have anything to do with these evil people? How can you use them to destroy your own people? It makes no sense. And we left poor Habakkuk standing on the ramparts, we presume up on this on the wall of Jerusalem, looking out on the city, maybe looking out over the terrain and thinking, am I the only one here who cares about this place? And that's where we leave him, waving his fist at God, saying, you better give me a fitting response to my complaint. All right, see if you can start blowing up that balloon. So I asked you last week what your expectations of God were. We all have them. What are your expectations of God? What do you think is best? And here you can have a brief discussion with someone next to you. Is it best to have high expectations? Or is it best to keep them low, manageable, reasonable? Expectations that won't lead to disappointment, perhaps. Have a quick, just a 2 minutes discussion between you. What do you think? You hold on to that for me. I can. Can you do it? Okay. Do you want me to try? Okay, consensus. Who, hands up if you think it's good to have high expectations. Oh, hands high, very good. Who thinks it's best to keep your expectations low, minimal, manageable? No one. Okay, all right. The nature of Habakkuk's prayer, his complaints, you could say, would imply that Habakkuk was very much like you. He liked to keep his expectations high. That's why he was complaining to God. He expected God to do something. And it's why he had his second complaint too. He was still maintaining, sustaining high expectations of God. What did God do with Habakkuk's expectations? Well done. Here, take some more balloons. You can hold on to those. I'll take the pin. Well done. He blew up his expectations. Or at least Habakkuk had blown up his expectations and God popped them. Left him very disappointed, very frustrated with God. This morning, we get to God's second response. God doesn't leave poor Habakkuk standing on the ramparts without a response. God responds to him, and he gives him what follows is a series of judgments, perhaps. Five curses, maybe. I'll leave you to read them on your own, in fact. But God predicts the fall of the Babylonians. He says, woe to those who pile up stolen goods. Woe to those who profit from plunder. Woe to those who build a city with bloodshed and establish a town by injustice. Woe to those who worship idols. It sure sounds like God has put Babylon in his crosshairs, doesn't it? If on the one hand he is raising up the Babylonians to deal with Israel, he's also raising them up so he can see a clear line of sight to shoot them, it would seem. But just Babylon? Do these woes only fit Babylon? Is God's judgment only fitting for Babylon? Doesn't this also fit Habakkuk's complaint about the way Israel is and what his first complaint seemed to describe? Isn't his own nation guilty of the same crimes? He cries out, violence. Why won't you do anything about the violence in your own people, God? He cries out, why is your justice perverted and only injustice? Why, in other words, do the leaders profit from plundering their own people? Why do the leaders get away with violence and murder? Why do those who have power and influence get to pervert justice? The complaint that Habakkuk raises about Israel is essentially the same when you map it against the woes. God is saying, whoever does these things, woe to you. Babylon and also Israel. Which begins to answer the reason why Israel is going to be dealt with harshly. Because if Habakkuk wants God to be a God of justice, guess what? He's going to be a God who is just in all situations. He will not show favoritism. Wherever there is evil, God has to deal with it. Otherwise, he's not a just God. So if there's violence in Israel and violence in Babylon, they'll be treated the same. It's a painful thing, I think, for him to hear. And in fact, you could argue that Israel perhaps had greater advantages over Babylon because God made it very clear what God wanted from them. God made it very clear what following him looked like. He made it very clear what justice looked like. They knew better than Babylon. That makes them even more guilty. Ouch. But wait. Derek looks up. I love that. It worked. Is God actually doing anything in these judgments? Are these five judgments, five woes, the result of God's action? Or do they read as a list of consequences for your actions? If you plunder people, it says, well, people will plunder you. If you live by shedding blood, guess what? One day someone is going to be bigger than you and shed your blood. If one day you win the Rugby World Cup, guess what? You might not win it next time because someone might be better than you. If you're going to live by those principles. So maybe what God is also describing here is the state of the nations, plural, all of them, caught in this cycle that they can't get out of shedding blood and having their blood shed, of one nation getting bigger by destroying another nation. Isn't that the way that they're all acting? Isn't that what they all do? Isn't Babylon just the most recent in a long line of empires that have built their own strength by destroying others? And isn't that what's going to happen next when Rome comes along? And isn't that what happens next when, you know, what's the next one after that? I don't know. But there's the British Empire, then there's the American Empire. Isn't this that what happens on earth? We're caught in this cycle. And doesn't God just describe that? So look, this is a cycle you're in. You're stuck. You're, all of you are people who think you can only get ahead by destroying someone else. And I don't have to do anything to cause you bloodshed and pain. You will do it to yourselves. I just have to stand back, sadly, and watch. In fact, that's exactly how Paul describes God's wrath in the letter of Romans. In the first chapter, he explains that God's wrath is letting people suffer the consequences of their own actions, letting people over to their own thoughts, their own desires, their own beliefs. Wrath is God not intervening, but letting people suffer what they've chosen to suffer. I mean, if God is good, and if God is truth, and if God is reality itself, if you decide not to live according to God's ways, guess what? You're living in lies and in illusions and in ways that are unreal and will lead to destruction. It's just the way it is. And God doesn't have to do anything to cause pain. When God acts, he tries to prevent it. That's God's actions. But there is a way out. There is a way out, and it's threaded throughout God's judgments, his five woes. And I wonder if you picked up on them when you read it, because I know that you read this as homework earlier on. There are three things that are said in God's second response to Habakkuk. In verse 4, it starts off by saying, "See, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright." And then there's this little phrase inserted in the middle of the sentence that says, "But the righteous person will live by their faithfulness." And then it goes on, "Indeed, wine betrays him. He is arrogant and never at rest." So there's this funny little phrase inserted in the middle of a sentence that says, "The righteous person will live by their faithfulness." And then there's another weird line amongst all of these things in verse 14, where it says, "For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." And guess how much the waters cover the sea? Completely. The earth will be completely filled with the knowledge of the glory of God. If Babylon at the moment is godless, doesn't see God anywhere, one day everyone will see God everywhere. And maybe the faithful, even though others can't see him, can't help but see him. I'm sure that's you. If you step out of this building and look around you, you would see God's glory. You would look at his first book, creation itself, and go, "There's God. Look how good he is. Look how great he is. Look what he has made." And then the last line of his statement, which is rather good. Verse 20, "The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him." What a great way to end a comment in response, don't you think? "The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him." If the way of life for the godless is this restless, agitated, chaotic, always hungry, never satisfied way of being, then God has woven throughout this text and throughout our lives another way. It's like an off-ramp. Like everyone's going down in this direction. Everyone's caught up in the cycle of, I can only increase by someone else decreasing. I can only get ahead if I get over someone else. This sense that we never have enough, that we're never going to have enough. That's the highway, the small path, this tiny little narrow road that's woven in between all of this, as it's woven just a few verses in this text, is this other way of peace. In the midst of everything, in the midst of the judgments and the woes, is this, "But the righteous will live by their faithfulness." The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. The Lord is in his holy temple. Just sit down and be still. That's the off-ramp. That's the alternative course offered. Let me read, in fact, these three lines. I'm going to slightly rephrase them. And just attend to what impact they have on you as I read these. Just listen to them, eyes closed if that helps, and see what happens. Those who are right with God by fully trusting in Him are also fully alive, really alive. Even the earth itself will be filled with awareness of God's glory like the waters covering the sea, because God is in His holy temple and we can be still, quiet, at peace. How does it feel? Does it have any impact on you? That's how it should be. That is in the midst of all of that chaos, all of that judgment, all of that woe. Nothing in your life has changed at the saying of those words, except your focus, maybe. Everything else is still the same. All the troubles that you came in this door with, your health issues, your worries about your children, maybe your financial issues, the paperwork, the things that you have, all of these things are still there. But in the midst of that, there's a moment that you can grasp anytime, anywhere, peace with God. And Habakkuk gets it. As those words of God wash over him, the judgment, but also that phrase perhaps, the righteous, Habakkuk, they will live by faithfulness, not by judgment. He gets there. I imagine actually there's a bit of a lull after God says those words, and the Lord is in his holy temple, let the earth be silent before him. And I suspect he probably was for a moment silent. But he does respond. And his final words are full of faith. And it begins by remembering God, what God has done. He recounts the great story of Exodus from Egypt. In fact, it's probably his rewrite of the Song of Miriam that Moses and Miriam sing when they've got through the Dead Sea, the Sea of Reeds, to the other side, and they've seen God deal with Egypt and all of his soldiers, and they're on the other side, and they praise God for his greatness. It's almost the same as far as its intent and its power. And as he recounts that, his faith grows. But nothing has changed. Babylon's still coming. So I want to do something this morning with you as well. Because when I think of what, if I need to refresh my memory of what God's done, stuff comes back from me from the past, things that I've learned. And there was a song that I had when I was in Sunday school. It's an action song. So we're going to do this together, and Jennifer's going to run the keys for us. It's a song called My God Is So Big. Does anyone know the song? Was it? Yeah. Yep, okay. Yeah, Susie knows it. So there are actions to the song. My God is so big, so strong and so mighty. I mean, you can do your own mighty strong thing if you like. There's nothing my God cannot do, okay? Mountains are his, the valleys are his, the stars are his handiwork too. All right, let's stand, let's do the song. So this is us remembering God and who he truly is, all right? With the childlike faithfulness that we got the song from. My God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. True. My God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. The mountains are His, the valleys are His, the stars are His handiwork too. My God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. Okay, so now obviously this probably would have been sung in the Middle East. Habakkuk is Jewish. So we're going to do it in a Middle Eastern tone. Right, so Jennifer will lead us in that. All right.
My God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. My God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. The mountains are His, the valleys are His, the stars are His handiwork too. My God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do.
All right, so that's what Habakkuk did. You can all take a seat now. Thank you, Jennifer. It was brilliant. Habakkuk recalled how big his God was. Habakkuk reminded himself of what God had done for Israel. And if God had done that and God hadn't changed, guess what? He could do it again. Nothing has changed. Babylon is still coming. There's still disaster for Israel. But Habakkuk's faith is renewed. I particularly love how Habakkuk ends his words that show you the place where he has arrived at, full of trust. He says, though the fig tree does not bud and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. Though the bubbles don't blow, I will be joyful in God my Savior, he says. The Sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He enables me to tread on the heights. How do you feel? Having gone through this short journey with Habakkuk, does it move you? See, I haven't done it properly. I haven't done it how Habakkuk would have wanted me to do it. I haven't followed his instructions. This book is not what you thought it was. A little detail right at the end of the story that tells us what this book really is. It's a play, more likely a musical, an opera, maybe a Shakespearean tragedy. It's meant to be done to music. It's unique, as far as we can tell, from the other prophetic books. And at the end it says to be accompanied by musical instruments. So what this is Habakkuk giving his people some pastoral support. He knows what's coming. And he knows the questions the people are asking. And he asks them for them. He asks them of God on behalf of the people. Again, as I said, that's unusual for the prophets. They're normally God's spokespeople to the people. He is the spokespeople of the people to God. So imagine you're walking through Jerusalem, and maybe you've heard that Babylon's coming. Maybe you've got Jeremiah's judgments ringing in your ears because he was roaming around at the same time. And you come along to this play. Maybe it's in one of the courts in the temple. And there's this play being acted out. And as you come along, you hear these words and you think, man, I've been making those same prayers. Those are my complaints. And there's this music to it. And you know what musicals are like. My son hates musicals. Musicals often are really quite fun. The music helps you engage emotionally in the story, doesn't it? You get caught up in the story with the music. And the music, as the music plays and these words are being told, the people get caught up in the story and they realize it's their story and Habakkuk is telling it for them. And maybe they learn the rhythms and the melodies. And they go on this journey of faith with Habakkuk. Because, you know, you don't get to the end without going from the start. You don't get to that faithfulness that Habakkuk ends up with unless you go through having it refined, going through the valley of the shadow. You have to go on the journey, and he takes them on the journey with him for them. So at the end they go, yeah, those are my words too now. Even though the crops fail, even though there are no cattle, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. Oh, these are terrible, aren't they? This is my prophetic act. Slightly pathetic act. We are like bubbles, aren't we? Pretty. Kind of fun to be around. In the grand scheme of time, we last about that long. We're lovely to look at. We're a gift at a party, some of us. But we pass so fast. And our hopes, no matter how high they are, eventually they fail. If we're just going to rely on the bubble life. Look at that tiny, pathetic little one. You know, that's some of us, right? Some come out big and glorious, and some are just barely visible. That's us. It's a potluck, who you are, what you come out as, it would seem. If there is no God, if there is no God, you have no right to have any expectations, to have any hopes. You last about that long in the grand scheme of things. What do you justify your hopes and beliefs and expectations on? If there is no God. And if we last about as long as a bubble, if that is about as meaningful our life is, if you can read the book of Ecclesiastes, by the way, there's a whole series of literature from the wisdom literatures on this. Consider your death, O young ones. Everything is meaningless, the writer in Ecclesiastes says, or everything is vapor, or in my language, everything is just a bubble. It comes out and looks good, but it doesn't last. And no matter how high you go or how big you are, you still come down pretty quick. And there's not much residue left unless there is a God. If there is a God, everything changes. Which is where Habakkuk ends up. All his hopes and dreams and expectations, they only mean anything if God is real and God alone can satisfy them. Habakkuk has no reason to expect anything of God for Israel unless God is real and cares about Israel. And we are the same. We have no reason or any justification to expect anything of our lives or beyond our life unless God is real and God is really big. And the bigger your God is, guess what? It doesn't matter how meaningless your life feels. All of a sudden it feels impenetrable and it feels indomitable because God is God, not you. I'm a bubble. I'm going to pass. But I'm a bubble who has faith in a God who can make me last. Who can take my frail, unjustifiable hopes and dreams and say, yes, Philip, because I love you. You may be a bubble, but you're mine, and I care about you. That was my life. Oh boy, I'm going to give up on this one. So as I close this part, consider the words of Jesus to his disciples. We know something Habakkuk didn't. We know someone Habakkuk didn't. We know Jesus. And just hours before his tragic death, before the life that was truly meaningful comes to a seemingly meaningless end, he says these words, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God. Believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you I'm going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am." We have no right to hope in anything except Jesus told us we can. And if we believe in him, it's all good. If we are full of faith in that, everything else is endurable. And the words of comfort that Jesus offers to the last disciple he made on earth. He's hung between two criminals, and one of them mocks him. One of them, it says, hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus answered him, "Truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." As the only place to place our faith and our hope on the words of Jesus, who is the Son of God. So have high hopes. Have extraordinarily high hopes. Not because our life warrants it, but because his does. Not because what I said means anything, but because of what he said. Have the highest hopes. Have higher hopes than just your bubble life, my bubble life. It will pass so fast, but there's something coming that is so much better. It makes this life actually make a lot more sense. I'd like you to engage and join me in this prophetic act of blowing bubbles. A little something I prepared earlier. They can mean anything that you want them to mean. They can be your hope. It can be an act of trust in God. If you want to do that. Yeah, but get them down to the kids and they can. And if you do one, then you can actually pass it on once you've done your bubble blowing. Man, your bubbles are so much better than mine, Wendy. If the kids get them, they can all bring them up at the front and make as many bubbles as possible. Just fill the place with bubbles. Go. I'll try and join you, but I don't guarantee anything. Oh. Got to swirl it. Woohoo! Nope. You make sure you blow, don't breathe in. You want to help me with the table? Oh, not over here. Oh, you're running out. You're running out. All right. The answer's the solution. And the solution, yeah. That's pretty good. Oh, isn't he clever? All right. So I'm just going to have a quick word about communion. And you guys can go over there and keep blowing as many bubbles as you like. Where you go, Susie? Oh my goodness, you've lost it. In the grand scheme of things, the few years that Jesus spent on earth and the fewer years he spent in ministry, you'd think, what on earth could he do to make any difference? It's a good thing that he is the Son of God and that his life is not measured in time so much as potency. And he is, as a resurrected Lord, now eternal, but his time on earth is meaningful because it was so potent. A pure man, the Son of God, who died for us. And his life and his teaching, his example, his death and his resurrection and the giving of his Spirit to us all comes together to give us hope too. Give us a purpose in life, a reason to live. So I'm going to invite you to the table. Take a cup, piece of bread, go back to your seat. And pray big, expectant prayers of God. As it says in your word, Lord, that if you are for us, who can be against us? That there is nothing in heaven or on earth that can separate us from your love. No matter how frail we feel, no matter what troubles we face, you sustain us and give us promise of something greater. And so we hold to that this morning, Lord. Faithfulness in you. And nothing else. Amen. I invite you to come forward.